Hi, I'm Nathan Scott, and thank you for tuning in to Sunday Morning, our final podcast for the year. And I have a very special guest in studio with me this morning. It's the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, Mr. Boyd Rutherford. Mr. Rutherford, thank you so much for taking the time to come in this morning.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
So the first question that I have, and I would imagine it's one that a lot of people have, but maybe too embarrassed to admit, is what exactly does your job entail? I think a lot of people, when they hear Lieutenant Governor, kind of assume that the main job is just being ready if something happens to the governor of the state. But I know it's more involved than that. What does your day-to-day schedule look like?
Well, you probably be a little surprised. A lot of people do ask that question in terms of what does the Lieutenant Governor do? But they're right when they think in terms of it being the backup to the governor. Constitutionally in Maryland, that is really the only constitutional duty is to come in for the governor if he cannot continue. But what we've decided to do, we, the governor and myself, have decided that we would work together on a lot more issues that we're very much involved. I'm very much involved in what he is doing. Involved in any meeting I want to go into, and of course all the staff meetings. We meet regularly one-on-one to talk about issues or just to catch up. And then there are areas where he specifically asked me to take on, such as the opioid issue, as well as opportunity zones and a couple of other areas, regulatory reform being another. And then areas of particular interest to me, coming out of the opioid issues, mental health and how we address mental health in the state. So There are a lot of benefits. I sometimes call being a lieutenant governor is like being the prince, where you have all the privileges without all the responsibility. And it allows me to do things or get involved in areas that I'm particularly interested in. Like I said, on the mental health side, as well as procurement reform, since I have a background in procurement. But there's the only constitutional duty is to step in for the governor when he can't perform.
And we'll attempt within the space of this program to get to all of those things that you just mentioned, at least to some degree. But as far as that main constitutional responsibility, being the governor's backup, you have had to step in for the governor before, specifically when he was going through his cancer treatments.
Right.
On top of the long career that you had in politics before you became lieutenant governor, is there anything, any part of that experience serving as the acting governor for the state that you now use in your job on a regular basis?
Well, I think it helped me understand. Well, first of all, just the fact that things can change at a moment's notice. And so you have to be prepared to go in. It's like being a backup quarterback or something. You have to be prepared at any time to go in. I think as I talked about it a little bit, the relationship that the governor and I have, as well as how we decided that we're going to govern, you know, jointly. Of course, I'm the junior partner in this. I understood what was going on and some of the decisions that he had already made, and I understood how he would want to make decisions going forward. So it wasn't as much of a challenge. But it did give me an opportunity to see a little bit more of the pressures and challenges that he faces as governor.
So one of his top priorities as governor, and one of yours as well, is something that you already mentioned, which is the heroin opioid epidemic. It's something that in the past year has gotten a lot of national media attention as well, and specifically affects us in Maryland as a result of the 95 corridor and, of course, all of the drug misuse that goes on in the area of Baltimore, as well as across the state. With him focusing more on the criminal enforcement side of things, that leaves the mental health side of things, which is equally important to address. Have there been any real sort of milestones as far as progress is concerned within the years that you've been working on it?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing some hopeful light at the end of the tunnel. We've seen a reduction in fatalities associated with overdoses. What has changed over the last several years is really the influx of fentanyl and fentanyl being mixed with heroin, but also other substances. We're starting to see more fentanyl-related deaths from cocaine being mixed with it than we had what we're seeing with heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And so overall, though, we're seeing the fatalities go down. We're hoping that that means that more people are going into treatment, less people are starting in that process. And so we think that that's helping. Mm-hmm. There's greater awareness. We put substantial resources into treatment facilities, as well as treatment in the local jails, as well as in our prisons, so that when people come out, they don't return to that type of life and lifestyle. So there's a lot of work to be done. Mm-hmm. We're hopeful that we're making progress in that area now.
Have there been, in the time that you've been working on this, any challenges that you've encountered getting people to think of this not just as a criminal issue, but also as a mental health issue?
Yes. We still run into that. There are a lot of people who do not, they see it as a moral flaw.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of two groups of people who are addicted or suffering from substance use disorder. Those who are long-term heroin users, who may have started heroin recreationally, and many of those had started with marijuana and went on to heavier drugs after that. And then there are those who started taking prescription medications, not recreationally, but based on an injury they had, on a doctor's order, and they may have taken more than they probably should have, or they may have had a predisposition to becoming addicted. You know, up until the doctors started to realize the addictive nature of the Oxycontins and the Percocets and things of that nature, they might give a person a 30-day supply for this when it had to do with dislocated shoulder or even, you know, a hip or knee replacement or any type of you know, trauma that they went through. And in many cases, the person didn't need 30 days of that. And if the person is starting to become dependent on it, they may feel that they're still in pain, not realizing that they're actually starting to become dependent on that substance, and call their doctor, and the doctor will just renew it and say, okay, well, we'll give you another 30-day supply. By that time, they're becoming dependent. And so then as the doctors start to pull back and say, look, I can't give you another supply of this, they start to buy those opioids on the street, and eventually someone tells them that heroin will do the same thing or better for less money. And we have that group. That was really the surge of new users that came in, were the people coming off prescription medications. But no matter how you get there, once you become dependent on it, it essentially is an illness. And your body is telling you you need this substance. And then there's a psychological aspect, because you can be detoxed, but then psychologically you have to understand, just like alcohol, that it's a day-to-day process of staying sober in the case of alcoholics, but it's the same thing for someone who's suffering from an opioid addiction.
So, you know, this affects all communities across the state of Maryland, be they well off or be they worse off financially. It's something that can affect everybody in every place, rural or urban. And an issue that everyone, you know, typically everyone knows someone who has been impacted by this, whether it's someone who's working on or working with people who are suffering with this disease, or people who are dealing with it themselves. Is there any way that you can tell the difference between the two sorts of users, or do you really just have to get to know the person?
Yeah, you have to get to know the person. It's not easy to tell the difference. I mean, other than asking them, you know, how they started, and there are people that, you know, started recreationally with prescription drugs. You know, they would find them. You heard stories at least a couple of years back where kids would have pill parties. You know, basically they'd bring these pills and that they found in a medicine cabinet and just take them to see what the effect was. So you really only know by talking to the person. I mean, there are going to be people who were long-term users. Baltimore City has been a heroin town since I was a boy. I mean, it wasn't at the level that it is now, but there was always a certain population within the city that was using heroin, and some of those people are, you know, they're older now, their bodies are breaking down, they may be transitioning or trying to get off and using methadone or something else. But we're also seeing these individuals, older people, that are getting fentanyl, and it's killing them.
So I'd like to talk about two other communities in particular, not having to do with heroin and opioids, but two of the other things that you work on within your office. You lead both the Opportunity Zone Task Force as well as the Two Generation Commission. And for anybody who may not know what either of those are, the Opportunity Zone Task Force is primarily dealing with particular zip codes or particular communities that are, you know, disadvantaged in some way, whether that be financially or just don't have the resources that they need to build their communities up, and the government stepping in and helping provide some of those resources. The Two Generation Commission then dealing with generational poverty, the American dream being that children should always be able to do better than their parents, but in some cases you see the grown children using the same resources, poverty-based resources, that the parents did.
Right.
Is there any way in which those two things, opportunity zones and generational poverty, are related to each other, or ways in which solving problems in one area could help in another?
Yeah, I think they are. They can be related. And even when you talk about the whole issue of mental health and substance use disorder, all of these can be related and can be reasons why people are staying in poverty, and there's not a, what I like to say, an off-ramp, an off-ramp to poverty, to a point where you can be self-sufficient. The opportunity zones, you know, they're focused on areas where you may have higher areas of poverty. The income levels are lower, and so those are communities that could use the investment that may come in through the tax incentives that the federal government provides and some of the incentives that the state provides in terms of new development and job creation primarily. So if you can get job creation, and we have worked hard with our Department of Labor to put in incentives for the people who live in the opportunity zones to make sure that they can work in those opportunity zones. That if you get jobs, as many people have said over the years, the best social program is a good job. So if you can get people that are using public services now, get them into employment, that helps along the way. Now, one of the challenges with that we are working with in terms of the two generational approach, or two gen for short, is there's something called a benefit cliff. If you make less than a certain amount of money, there's certain benefits that you qualify for in terms of maybe temporary cash assistance, there are the food stamps, there's housing assistance and things of that nature. As your income goes up, you start to lose some of those. And so a person can be on a threshold, and typically it's a family. It's a, you know, maybe a single parent and one or two children. You can be on a threshold where you are working, but if you get a promotion or you get more hours, you may lose a benefit. And so what we've been working on is a transition, a transition period. Maybe it's 3 months that you don't lose the benefit. You can take the higher income job but not lose your benefit for 3 months, so it can allow you to start, you know, putting away some money that you're prepared when you lose that benefit. And the same thing goes as you go up in terms of your income. There are different areas where you start to lose these benefits. And so that's one of the areas, because we want to take away that disincentive where a person says, hey, I'm going to lose my child care subsidy if I take this promotion or I take this new job. And it's like, well, maybe there's a way that that subsidy can be continued for some period of time, so it can allow you to prepare yourself, put some money in the bank, and prepare yourself to be able to pay for that.
And I've seen this happen as well. I used to work in the grocery business, one of my first jobs, and one thing that I saw a lot of the time is people who would come in, they'd be on food stamps or WIC checks or what have you, and just when they reached the point where they could begin to afford groceries with the money, you know, with their budget as it currently is, with the food stamps, that's the cutoff for the benefits. And so then you end up right back in the position you were in before you went on food stamps to begin with. So if I'm understanding you correctly, it sounds like you're trying to, you know, like you said, a benefit cliff, eliminate that drop off, so that way people can ease into you know, effective, well-budgeted life, as opposed to just constantly going around in circles.
Yeah, yeah. There's, and some states, what they do is they will, you know, extend it, but they may scale it down.
Mm-hmm.
That your benefit may be a little less every month for, say, a six-month period. So you get a chance to kind of understand that, okay, I'm going to have to do some things differently. I may have to work a little bit more. I'm going to have to do something. But it's not where it just drops off immediately when you get a little bit more money in your paycheck.
Well, if you're just tuning in, my name is Nathan Scott. You're listening to Sunday Morning, and I'm speaking with the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Maryland, Boyd Rutherford. We've been talking already about the heroin opioid epidemic, as well as Opportunity Zones and the Two-Generation Commission. I want to move now to something which you touched on in your description of what your office is responsible for, which is the Regulatory Reform Commission. One of Governor Hogan's big priorities for the state of Maryland is making it very business and small business in particular friendly.
Right.
Maryland being open for business was you know, all over the campaign ads. And you in particular have also run on the platform of making government more effective. Can you describe what are some of the solutions that you've had a hand in creating, specifically those that help local business people?
Right. Well, one of the things that we, you know, we found with the commission, and we had meetings around the state, talked to people, let people come in and tell us the challenges that they had with what we did. And one of the big issues really was something very simple, and it was just customer service.
Mm-hmm.
It was just being responsive, returning phone calls, not sending people to too many places when they, you know, dead end. As I give the example, and it's less accurate now, but like if you went to motor vehicles and, you know, you stand in line and this one, you get up to the window and they tell you you need to go to a different window.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been standing in line for 35 minutes or so just to get there to go to another line. It's changing that re-engineering how we do things in all of our departments that face the customer, be it be it a private citizen or business or small business or someone trying to get a license to open a business, making sure that we are treating them like customers. They may not have a choice of where to go, unlike if you're shopping or something of that nature, but they are our customers because they're paying all of our salaries. That was really the biggest thing. One of the areas that, you know, we were able to address early on and it helped with the legislature, but most of it was regulatory, was changing regulations to allow for the ride-sharing companies to come in. Many of our regulations were based on the old taxi regulations, and so it was how does the Ubers and Lyft, you know, fit into that model. And of course, the taxi companies didn't want them to come in at all. And my response to them was generally, you guys could have done the same thing. You just need to find some 16-year-old to create an app for you. But you already had the cars. You had, you know, you could have done the same thing. They still could. But, you know, we had to make some regulatory changes to make sure that new innovation comes in, as well as taking a fresh look at all of our regulations. Some of them just were inconsistent with statute may have changed, but the regulation hadn't changed. There may have been some things where the interpretation of the regulation was not consistent. So we were able to go through and amend or eliminate some 800-plus regulations.
And are there any ways in which this regulatory reform can help the people that we were referring to earlier, people who are in opportunity zones or a part of generational poverty? What are some of the ways in which regulatory reform can improve their lives?
Well, I give an example that it may be a person that's in poverty but has particular challenges. It could be barriers to jobs. There's what's called collateral consequences, and most of it is in regulation, where a person who has some type of criminal offense can't get certain jobs. Now, some of them make sense. If you're an embezzler, maybe you shouldn't be a bookkeeper, okay? If you child molesting, you shouldn't work in a daycare center. But there were some provisions that said that if you had a misdemeanor or a felony, you couldn't be an apprentice mortician, which is an undertaker, in other words.
Right.
So you couldn't be an apprentice mortician and then eventually become a mortician. the regulation still said that. The statute had changed. The statute said that the board could decide if you didn't have an offense within the last 3 years, and you basically were a good person since then. So it was a barrier to work. I mean, there are others. You couldn't work in a daycare, not a daycare, but a senior facility, even as a driver in a senior facility. And we know how those laws come about is that somebody fleeces some older person in the senior facility. They fleece them, and they happen to have had a criminal record before. And so you get some legislator that stands on the state house floor and says, well, we'll never let that happen again. Well, if family members fleece family members, and there's always – it doesn't mean that just because that person had a background that they're going to do this. It's worth taking a look. We took a look at those types of regulations as well. There's still others. There's a lot that we need to go through. But we looked at those that could be a barrier to a person who's really trying to get their life together. And it may have been 15 years ago that they had some – offense when they were 18 or 19 years old. And now everybody loves them, but they can't get that job because they had that misdemeanor several years ago. So that's one area. Others, there was one that came up with regard to cosmetology, where one of the new things now is something called, I guess it's like drying, the dryers or something, blowout or whatever. I forgot what they call it. But you had to get a cosmetology license to be able to basically wash somebody's hair and dry the hair. And that regulation changed a little bit. You didn't need to be versed in all the chemicals that people put in their hair. I don't have to worry about that because I don't have much hair now, so I don't have to worry about those types of things. Hannah might have to because she's got a lot of nice hair over there.
Hannah, in this case, being the representative from his communications office, for anyone who has no idea who we're talking about.
But. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, you can't see that on radio, right?
No. So. I'm actually happy that we've gotten to this point because we're getting close to the end of our time. But I do want to end on a bit of a lighter note, which is one of the favorite things of mine that your office is doing, which is the Maryland State Park Bucket List Challenge. Designed, first of all, to get to see all the state parks, I would imagine it's great for you, but also to bring awareness to the fact that Maryland has been called America in miniature before. We have a lot of different types of parks, all within a relatively small state. How far along that list are you? I think you've been going for, over a year now?
No, it's been just 1 year, really.
Really?
Well, we used one of the parks that I had hit before, but basically we really started the challenge January 1st of last year.
Okay.
And we'll be going back out on January 1st. While a lot of people are sleeping over their hangovers and stuff, we'll be walking around in the park January 1st. We've hit 16 parks out of 75.
Okay,
so we
got
have a ways
to go.
I don't know if I'm going to hit them all, but it's been good. And it is, like you said, bringing awareness to the wonderful parks that we have. Many of them are known, like the Sandy Point and some of the others. And many people in different counties are very aware of the parks that they have. But there are areas of the state that, if you live in one area of the state that may not know about the parks that are out in Western Maryland or some of them that are on the lower eastern shore and what you can do there. This summer we were canoeing in Caroline County, and we were kayaking down in Wicomico County. And so, different parks around, and we stayed in a cabin out in Western Maryland and New Germany. That might have been my favorite park, New Germany. And in February we plan to do a winter park in Garrett County, and possibly snowshoeing or cross country skiing. So we'll see which one.
Are there any other parks that are going to be coming up that you're particularly looking forward to being able to visit?
Yeah, the one Swallow Falls, that's going to be in February in Western Maryland. But we're going out on January 1st. January 1st nationally is First Hike Day.
Right.
Yeah. And so I started last year doing that, and we're going to Patuxent River State Park this January 1st. So I'm looking forward to that. So we'll see how cold it is. And last year wasn't too cold, but I don't really care. As long as you dress for it, it's fine.
Right.
Well, my staff might care, but I don't care.
You've got a lot on your plate. I think if I'm doing the math correctly, that's another 59 state parks left to go.
So. I don't know if we'll hit them, but we're going to try. We're going to try. You know, the time gets tight. It's kind of easy to do one a month, but sometimes you're able to get to two parks in a day because they may be fairly close to each other, and so you can do that.
And really, regardless of how many you get to, just seeing the posts go up on social, seeing all the different sorts of ecosystems, and also state parks are not just natural, they're historic as well.
Yes, many of them are historic parks, right.
You know, Maryland's someplace that has a rich history as well, from the Revolutionary War through the Civil War, all the way up through World Wars I and II, the Civil Rights Movement to the present day.
Yeah.
So you get to see a lot of that on that trip. We've talked about a lot on this program, the state parks, the heroin opioid epidemic, opportunity zones, regulatory reform. If anybody wants to get in contact with your office about any of those things, you know, leave a comment or even just inquire about what your position might be. Maybe get involved themselves. What are some of the best ways to get in contact?
Well, they can always email me at lt.governor@maryland.gov.
Mm-hmm.
That's LT as in Lieutenant Titan, dot governor at maryland.gov is one way. They can follow on Facebook. They'll see where typically where I've been. Sometimes we announce where we're going on Facebook. And, of course, you know, they can follow on Twitter, at Boyd K. Rutherford on Twitter as well, and Instagram. I don't remember what my Instagram handle is, but you can find it. I guess it's at Boyd K. Rutherford. In the Instagram, you can follow where we go to.
Hopefully, it's the only one that says Lieutenant Governor of Maryland on it.
Hopefully, yeah. I think I found another Boyd K. Rutherford website out there or something. But yeah, you'll know. In the Twitter, it has the little check mark.
Right.
The Facebook says Lieutenant Governor.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
If you've just been tuning in, my name is Nathan Scott. You've been listening to Sunday Morning, and my guest has been the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, Boyd Rutherford. If you would like more info, then you can email lt.governor@maryland.gov. I'm Nathan Scott, and until next time, have a great day.